Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm your host, Nicole Engelbrecht, and this is episode 31, The Serial Crimes of Sipho Dube. This episode was first released in May 2020. As part of my ongoing project to ensure that I have represented minor victims correctly and legally throughout the podcast, I've reviewed this episode and made some changes. I've also changed the title, which was originally The Mind Dump Child Killer. Over time, I've come to find more value in either naming the victim, if it is a single victim crime, or naming the perpetrator, if it's a series. Catchy titles, often used in the media, are not helpful to the memory of the victims. And so that is one of the changes I've made here. I've also re-recorded the episode. So if you're listening to the podcast in order from episode one for the first time, you're about to hear Nicole from the future. If you listen to this episode when it was originally released, I have added additional information that I've come across since the original release. Plus, it's 6 years since you listened to it last, so it's worth continuing on. I chose to cover today's case because we all find serial killer cases interesting, and this one is a bit different. The perpetrator in this case was a ghost of sorts. His birth had never been registered, and if he hadn't been caught for committing other crimes, the system would likely never have known he even existed. This case is also different because despite police being aware that there was a serial offender on the loose, and a profile being drawn up, the offender was actually caught by a member of the public. Twice. Famed detective Piet Bijleveld was involved in this case, but only after the man was apprehended. Both times. Bijleveld says in his book, Dossier of a Serial Sleuth, which I used as one of my sources for this episode, that the offender in this case was one of the strangest people he'd ever interrogated. And for a man who, during his career, arrested and interviewed some of South Africa's most violent and abhorrent offenders, that's saying a lot. Today's case does include horrific violence and sexual assault against children, so please do consider whether you may be triggered by such content. Cases involving children are, of course, never easy to cover, and many podcasters avoid them. I feel that the difficult cases are the most important ones to talk about. Giving a voice to victims is the reason I do this, and the most vulnerable of our society deserve that just as much as any other victim. So, let's get into episode 31, The Serial Crimes of Sipho Dube. Mhlumayo, near Ladysmith in KwaZulu-Natal, is a mountainous region of the province. It's a relatively rural area, occupied largely by people who have grown up there. Livestock farming is popular in the area, which is about 40 kilometres outside of Ladysmith. In a community that is rather closed off from the rest of the world, petty criminals are often dealt with by the community. For many years, such communities did not trust police, and that aversion did not immediately disappear when apartheid officially ended. In 2003, though, Mhlumayo would be forced to recognize that their brand of community justice didn't work on everyone. And sometimes, a troubled child was far more dangerous than they appeared. On that day in 2003, police drove into town and started asking questions about a previous resident. He was a man who had fled the town 2 years before, and the community and what was left of his family had hoped that the young man had gone on to live a better life in Johannesburg. They were sorely mistaken. The aunt of one Sipho Dube was one of the last remaining members of his family left there. She recalled being shocked when the police told her what her nephew was accused of doing. As she started to tell the tale of Sipho Dube's childhood, though, for police and profilers, the pieces all started to fall into place. Sipho Dube was born in 1976. We don't know what day, and seemingly neither does he, because his birth was never registered. The government of South Africa was never advised that a baby called Sipho Dube had entered the world. He had no birth certificate or identity book, and his fingerprints never entered the system. Sipho Dube was a ghost, but he had been very real to the people of Mhlumayo. Sipho's father was never officially identified. His mother had been a traditional healer in the community. His aunt told police that the boy had been difficult to deal with from a very young age. He committed his first known crime at the age of 7, when he stole a neighbour's radio. When he was caught and questioned, he allegedly told the victims that they were, quote, full of shit and should mind their own business, end quote. When he was 10 years old, he stole money from the local church altar, and his mother kicked him out of her house, sending him to live with his grandmother nearby. It's alleged that people were afraid of Sipho from a very early age. He had an incredible temper that would erupt without warning, and he had no problem being violent with children and adults alike. His teachers also had no control over him, and although they admitted that the boy hardly ever attended classes, when he did, he created chaos, beating up fellow pupils, threatening teachers, and refusing to listen to anyone. Sipho was expelled from school in grade 5 and never returned. Sadly, his teachers would add that he was actually one of their most intelligent pupils and spoke English better than some of his teachers did. Years later, they would wonder what, if anything, they could have done to turn little Sipho around. Shortly after he was expelled from school, Sipho Dube was hit by a bus. Barely clinging to life, he was rushed to hospital, where he spent 4 months having his legs reconstructed. He would bear the scars for the rest of his life. His aunt believes that this was another turning point for the boy. After the accident, he seemed to have absolutely no control over his anger. I do have to wonder whether, in addition to the leg injuries, Sipho may also have sustained a traumatic brain injury in this accident. Difficulties with impulse and anger control are common side effects of traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, and it's something I come across quite frequently in cases of violent offenders. I'm not for a minute saying that a TBI makes one a violent offender, of course, but it does seem to be quite a common injury, sustained at some point, by many also otherwise violent individuals. Because Sipho's life is largely undocumented, we have to rely on the memories of his family members, as well as his own claims, as to the events that made him who he was. He would claim that when he was a child, he was sexually assaulted by a visitor to the community. Sipho says that this event had only served to fuel the anger that was growing inside him. And from that day, he wanted to regain control by committing the same acts against other children. This feeling of a loss of control is something that is very normal for survivors of sexual violence to feel. Most, though, if they do not work through that in therapy, end up turning that desire for control on themselves, frequently manifesting in substance use issues or addictions to pornography, sex, gambling, or shopping. Self-harm is another way this feeling manifests. Only very few end up turning that harm back onto innocent victims. Shockingly, residents of Mhlumayo would say that as Sipho grew into a teenager, it wouldn't be strange to see him dragging young girls into the bushes, presumably to rape them. None of the rapes were ever reported, and the community was so afraid of Sipho that he was simply allowed to continue his activities. In 1997, when Sipho was 21, a neighbour had finally had enough of his reign of terror and reported him to the police for breaking into their home and stealing several items. He was sentenced to 18 months in prison for theft. In 1999, he was out again, repeated a similar offence, and was sent back to jail. In 2000, he was back in Mhlomayo, but not for long. We will never know exactly how many sexual assaults and rapes Sipho Dube committed, but on his return to his hometown, he so severely sexually assaulted a young girl that the community turned on him. With his neighbours baying for his blood, Sipho Dube fled Mhlomayo. He would never return home. We don't know Sipho's exact movements between 2000 and 2002 when he appeared in Johannesburg. But before he headed out to the City of Gold, he committed at least two more crimes, one being what is believed to be his first murder. In 2001, Sipho accosted a young boy who was riding his bicycle in Vienen, 30 kilometres from Mhlomayo. The word Vienen is Dutch for wept. The child was raped. And it was during this crime that Sipho started a strange ritual with his victims. Despite being atrociously violent and already a raging alcoholic, Sipho had dreams of becoming a pastor. He allegedly had significant knowledge of the Bible, and he decided that the fate of his victims would be determined by prayer. After sexually assaulting his victim, he would say a prayer. If it was what he considered to be a good prayer, he would allow the person to live. If his prayer was bad, they would die. The young boy in Vienen was left alive. On the 23rd of March 2001, Rishanti Singh, a widow and mother of two, told her mother that she was going to the bank and would return home a bit later. In reality, Rishanti had met a man that she'd enjoyed spending time with, and she knew that her mother would not approve of the relationship, so the couple kept their meeting secret. On that day, they'd arranged to meet at the Burgers Fort Monument on Wagon Hill near Ladysmith. The couple were chatting when they were approached by a man who wanted to rob them. Rishanti's male companion had taken the opportunity to run away, but she was left to suffer a violent beating. Her body was later found by a passerby. She had been beaten with several rocks which lay around her body, spattered with blood. She had not been raped. Sipho Dube had committed his first murder, although it would be another 2 years before anyone connected him to the crime. Now a murderer, Sipho fled to Johannesburg. The south of Johannesburg and its mine dumps seem to hold a strange attraction for serial murderers. Moses Sithole, Cedric Marke, David Selepe, Lazarus Mazinge, and even Daisy Demelka all started their murders around the mountains of waste created as a byproduct of gold mining. The dumps have grown vegetation in areas over the years, but by and large they remain places that you really only go if you need a secluded place to do something you should not be doing. It was around these mine dumps, under a bridge, that Sipho Dube made his home. He had no money when he arrived in Gauteng, no job, and although his mother would join him there not long afterwards, he continued to live on the street. He quickly gained a reputation among the homeless community as an extremely violent alcoholic. He was also well known for having extremely poor hygiene, even by the standards of homeless people, who of course don't have access to facilities to maintain hygiene. Most of these people, though, do their best to find places to clean themselves and their clothes when possible. Not Sipho Dube, though. He spent his time drinking and drifting on the streets, committing petty thefts, and soon, hunting. Forensic psychologist and profiler Gerard Labuschagne would later recall in an episode of his podcast Profiler Africa that toward the end of 2002, he and his investigative psychology unit at the SAPS had become aware of a case of a serial child rapist in the south of Johannesburg. His boss had actually heard about a case by chance on the radio. It was reported that a profile had been created for the offender, which Dr. Labuschagne and his team found strange, since they hadn't created any such profile. Gerard approached the officers handling the case and discovered that they had used a staff criminologist to draw up a profile of the offender. He offered to have his units draw up a comparable profile, as they had a lot more training and experience in dealing with serial offenders. As he looked at the four crimes in question, which had been committed between August and October of 2002, he immediately noticed an escalation in violence. All of the children had been lured into the mine dumps with promises of money, cell phones or toys in exchange for their assistance with some task that the offender had allegedly wanted done. The crimes were shocking in nature, with the children being subjected to violent rapes. With some of the victims, the offender would sickeningly give them options. They could choose between dying by stabbing, dying by strangulation, or they could choose to walk free. But in turn, they had to, quote, act like his wives, as he put it. In this absolutely twisted and stomach-turning manipulation, the offender made his victims choose the only option available to them, which led to their rape. To be clear, there is no consent when a choice is coerced, and children cannot consent to sex in any case. But one can only imagine the psychological effect it would have had on these children if they survived the crime to come to terms with this. It was this increased use of force that worried Gerard, though, and he put this in the profile he presented to detectives on the case. As the officers on the case belonged to units that only investigated sex crimes, Gerard's concern was that if their offender progressed to murder, which the increase in violence seemed to indicate was probable, these detectives would have no idea, because a detective from the murder unit would attend the scene. He suggested that a memo be circulated to all detectives in the area, that if a child murder was reported, the detectives on the rape series should be advised. It would later emerge that the sex crimes unit had identified a suspect from the description of one of the young victims. She described the man as short, with a goatee, and she recalled the terrible smell of body odour and stale alcohol, which had permeated the air as he had assaulted her. Inquiries in the area had led detectives to Sipho Dube, who they found living under a bridge near the scenes. Gerard Labuschagne described his horror at hearing how detectives had handled this identification. Instead of following procedure and arranging a lineup in which the victim would be protected and feel safe to give her opinion on whether this was the man who had raped her, detectives picked up Dube, drove him to the home of the victim, and stood him in front of her. The little girl was asked if this was the man who had raped her. "And what do you think?" she said. Of course she said no, because why would she incriminate this vicious, violent man who she was likely terrified of and who now knew where she lived? So the police released him. They returned him to his bridge. And when Gerard asked if they'd taken any of his identifying information, they claimed they had no reason to. This interaction with police would have a twofold effect on Sipho Dube. Firstly, although his violence was already increasing, and he was probably always going to end up killing a child, I have to think that he must have considered that leaving his victims alive was a risk which had just been proven to him. Sipho seemed to have quite enjoyed this interaction from a narcissistic perspective. It likely made him feel omnipotent, and as though he could continue doing as he pleased without being caught. It's not uncommon for killers to insert themselves into investigations. It helps them to determine where police are in their investigation, and it also gives them a thrill to be so close to police, with them having no idea that their killer is standing right in front of them. Sipho Dube took this to another level. In January 2003, 10-year-old Lucanyo Kuane was walking with a friend near Wemapan when they were accosted by Sipho Dube. Lucanyo's friend ran away, and an hour later, a passing motorist found the severely beaten body of the 10-year-old on the side of the road. The child had been sexually assaulted and beaten around the head and face with stones. He was barely clinging to life and unable to speak or see. The motorist stopped and called an ambulance, and a few pedestrians stopped to offer help. One was a homeless man who presented with a rather bad body odor. Sipho Dube watched with others as his victim was attended to. The motorist eventually decided that the ambulance was taking too long and he would take Lucanyo to the hospital himself. Dube helped lift the child into the back seat of the man's car. I can only hope that Lucanyo was not aware of what was going on around him at that point, because I cannot imagine the terror of being unable to speak or see, lying in unbelievable pain on the side of the road, and then hearing the voice of your attacker, or smelling his stench, with no way to communicate to those around you that it's him. He's the one. Lucanyo passed away in hospital the next day. He is believed to be the first child murder victim of Sipho Dube. Gerard Labiskakni's warning to sex crimes detectives that their serial rapist was about to become a murderer had come to fruition, but they didn't know it yet. Possibly because Lucanyo survived to get to hospital, his murder was not immediately brought to their attention. They had not seen any more rapes that they believed to be committed by that offender, and so they waited for the seemingly inevitable call from the murder unit. That call came on the 25th of April 2003. 12 days earlier, a 14-year-old boy had been reported missing by his parents. Thabo Ndlongolo was a responsible child, and the minute he didn't return from an errand, his parents knew something was wrong. Sadly, although the missing person's report was logged, a body found would not be identified as Thabo's until 2 years after his disappearance. In all fairness, there were very few identifying characteristics left behind when Thabo was found. He had been sexually assaulted and beaten severely around the head. In a horrifying development, Thabo's arms had also been severed and removed from the scene. The boy's parents had received telephone calls in the days after their son had gone missing. A man calling himself Sipho had called twice and told Thabo's parents that they should forget about their child because he was dead and dumped in the bushes. Thabo would be buried in a pauper's grave while his parents had no idea about his whereabouts for 2 years. And Sipho Dube continued with his hunt. In August 2003, a 14-year-old Nomnikelo Jumba was walking home from school when she was lured into the mine dumps. Her body was found at the bottom of the hill. She'd been raped and stabbed in the armpits, chest, and neck. As police surveyed the scene, a man appeared from the mine dump. He claimed to have seen everything. He led police up the hill to Nomnikelo's bloody school blazer and school books. He told police that the girl had been raped and stabbed at that spot, and then she'd escaped and run down the hill before collapsing and dying where she'd been found. As police listened to the vagrant describe events, they made a huge mistake. They failed to spot Nomnikelo's blood on the man's shoes. Sipho Dube walked away from the scene. On the 26th of September 2003, cousins Anele Mbuku, 9, and Siabonga, 12, arrived at their home in Malvern with an older man in tow. The boys had met Sipho Dube on the street, and he'd offered them a toy figurine for a few rand. The boys had come to ask Anele's mother if she could buy the figurine for them. The woman said that she didn't have any money and asked Sipho to leave. A few minutes later, she went to look for the boys and found them speaking to Dube outside. She told the man that if he didn't leave, she was going to call the police. She instructed the boys to follow her inside. Unfortunately, they did not listen. Instead, they followed Sipho Dube, and they were never seen again. On the 8th of November 2003, 11-year-old Tina Bernardes was with her cousin and her aunt, who sold secondhand clothing on the streets of Johannesburg. The young girl was described by her parents as kind, fun-loving, and always ready with a smile. Tina's aunt was approached by a man who told her that he had 2 cell phones to sell, and that if she helped him, she could keep part of the profit. The woman instructed Tina and her cousin to go with the man to fetch the phones. She was convinced that it was a safe situation, as both children were going together, and the man seemed genuinely concerned about their safety, even reminding the woman to give them a plastic bag to wrap the phones in so that they didn't become the victims of robbery on their way back. Tina and her cousin walked a few blocks with the man, and as they neared the mine dumps, her cousin became fearful and stopped walking. Tina told her cousin that she had to go with the man because her aunt had instructed her to, and she'd be angry if she didn't carry out her instructions. Her cousin turned around, and the man gripped Tina's arm as they made their way up the hill, disappearing into the mine dump. When Tina did not return from the errand, her family jumped into action immediately. Her mother, Jackie, and her father, Tino, galvanized the community, of which they were long-term residents, and soon posters were distributed and Tino was talking to local vagrants to see if they had seen anything. One homeless man, Alfred Nyanga, said that he had seen a man he knew as Sipho walking with a young girl that morning. Tino gave the man 50 rand and asked him to call him if he saw the man again. Just an hour later, Tino received a call from Alfred. He told the desperate father where to find Sipho. Tino jumped into his brother's car, and within 10 minutes they had bundled Sipho Dube into the back of the vehicle. Yes, this is technically kidnapping, but I think we can look past that considering the circumstances. They took Sipho to Tina's aunt, who confirmed that this was the man who had walked away with Tina. Their next stop was the police station, where they handed over Sipho Dube as the man who had taken Tina Bernardes. Little did he know But this terrified father had, with the help of a homeless man, apprehended one of South Africa's most horrifying child murderers. Sadly, there would not be a happy ending for the Bernardi's family. Later that same day, Tina's body was found on a nearby mine dump. She appeared to have been sexually assaulted. She had been beaten around the head with bloodied rocks that lay nearby. And then one of her fingers had been removed and taken from the scene. It was only after his arrest that police realized that they were dealing with a ghost, an undocumented person who not only would not speak to them, but would not speak at all. Sipho Dube also embarked on a hunger strike, although he refused to say what he was protesting. Police suspected that this was not Sipho's first crime, and they started to retrieve dockets for unsolved child murders that they thought could be attributed to him. Now, they just had to get him to talk. On the 12th of November, Piet Beyleveldt was told that there was a suspected serial killer in custody, and he was handed the docket for the Tina Bernardi's murder and asked to try to get through to Dube. Piet found Dube to be quite a challenge. For the first two interviews, he spent the entire time growling at Piet like a dog. The seasoned officer said he had never seen anything like it in his career. When an officer made an offhand comment to Piet that Dube constantly picked up cigarette butts from the floor and carried them in his pockets, he thought perhaps he should try a third time. This time, he brought cigarettes. The change in Dube, according to Piet, was visible. He softened, and as he smoked to his heart's content, he began to spill the beans. He told Beyleveldt that he actually wasn't sure how many people he'd killed, but he would tell them about the ones he remembered and take them to the scenes. As a reward, Piet bought the man chips, bread and milk, which he readily devoured. The full scope of Sipho Dube's crimes began to emerge as he admitted to killing Lukanyo Kuane, Nomnikelo Jumba, Anele and Siabonga Mbuku, and Tina Bernardi's. He also helped police to solve the riddle of missing Thabo Ndlogolo by telling them that he had severed the arms of one of his young victims and phoned the child's father. By putting these details together, police then showed Thabo's distraught parents pictures of the original crime scene, and they identified him by the clothing he had worn that day. Thabo was given his name back. Semen found on the body of one of the victims was the only physical evidence tying Dube to these crimes. But with his pointing out of the scenes, confessions and admission of information only the killer would know, police felt that they had a strong enough case against him. He was also tied back to the four sexual assaults, and the profile that Gerard Labuschagne had drawn up fit him like a glove. Sadly, the bodies of Anele and Siabonga Mbuku have never been found. Piet described a relationship of intense adoration and even more intense hate that Sipho Dube had with his mother. The man begged Piet to take him to see his mother, but when he did, he launched into a verbal tirade against the woman, accusing her of being the reason he'd become a killer. Alfred Nyanga, the homeless man who was essentially the hero of the tale along with Tina's dad, would have been the state's star witness in the trial. He had seen Sipho with Tina. Unfortunately, Alfred had disappeared, and he was never seen again. Sipho remained in jail while the state built their case against him and prepared for trial. Unfortunately, there would be a few hiccups in the road before then. On the 13th of January 2004, Sipho Dube was erroneously booked out of jail and transported to Wynberg Prison, It seems that he was mistaken for another prisoner, who was due to appear in court that day. When Sipo was asked his name at the court, it became known that his name was not on the court roll for that day, and court orderlies took an inexplicable course of action. Instead of sending him back to jail to figure out what the mix-up had been, they walked Sipho Dube, serial child killer and rapist, to the door of the court, opened it, and told him he was free to go. He would later laugh as he described how the court official had held the door open for him as he walked out into the street, a free man. Piet Bijleveld described finding out that Dube had been accidentally released as the moment that his fellow police officers saw a side of him they'd never seen before. The officers and the court officials involved in the bungle that day were disciplined, but that did not bring back a highly dangerous criminal, and so the hunt began. Over the next 3 months, Bijleveld headed up a manhunt for Sipho Dube, terrified that a child may just lose their life because of a stupid mistake. Sipho's mother agreed to help police find her son, but although it could never be proven, they believe she'd actually sent them on a wild goose chase by telling them that her son had fled to KwaZulu-Natal. Officers spent 5 days in the province searching for the man, to no avail. One day, an eagle-eyed police officer spotted something on the intake sheet of an offender that had been arrested just 4 days after Sipho Dube had escaped. The offender, who was awaiting trial for attempted car theft, had been apprehended by a member of the public, the owner of the car that was the target of the theft. The offender had been booked in under the name Clifford Mbata, but the next of kin name belonged to Sipho Dube's mother, and the cell phone number matched hers too. The officer made a call to Piet Bijleveld, and within the hour, the man was looking at Sipho Dube's smiling face through the bars of his cell. He greeted Piet with, "Sorry, Mr. Piet." Despite the huge amount of wasted resources, Bijleveld was just glad that Sipho had only been back on the street for 4 days and hadn't had the opportunity to harm any more children. As a form of apology to the detective, who seemed to have earned his trust, Sipho told Piet that he wanted to tell him about a murder he'd committed in Ladysmith. He confessed to the murder of 38-year-old Rishanti Singh, whose murder was still unsolved. Without this confession, there is no doubt that the crime would never have been tied to Dube, as it is so far outside of his victim profile and modus operandi. This murder was added to his charge sheet, and eventually he faced 41 total charges of murder, rape, robbery, and assault. He pleaded not guilty to all of them. Piet Bijleveld says that it is not uncommon for offenders that confess to him and with whom he forms a sort of bond of trust to suddenly turn on him in the courtroom. He'd experienced it many times, and it was almost as though the reality of the courtroom caused the offenders to suddenly realize that they'd been lulled into a place of trust by Bijleveld. Of course, the man never gave any of these offenders the impression that if they confessed, they would not face court action. But it seemed that these largely intelligent men found it embarrassing that this policeman had gotten them to talk about their crimes. This is most certainly the case with most serial offenders, who may confess in full and even point out scenes. But once it gets to court, and perhaps the rush of the moment of attention has passed, or legal minds have advised them, they attempt to retract their confessions and plead not guilty. Sipho Dube was no different, but the way he showed his disdain for the system was seriously over the top. If anyone was in any doubt as to which side of Sipho Dube his victims had seen just before their deaths, they received a very clear display in court. Hardly a day went by without an outburst from Dube. He screamed at photographers and court sketch artists that if they took his photo or sketched him, he would strangle them and drive over their testicles with a car. He threw himself downstairs, tried to set himself on fire, and even ripped a microphone out of the dock and threw it at the victims' families. Dube's psychiatric assessments had come back with no clinical diagnosis, but he would later say that he didn't need a psychiatrist to tell him how a serial killer was made. In the words of Dube, quote, "When anger boils up inside and I have no outlet to cool me down, I lash out. But when I kill, I smile. That is a serial killer." End quote. Sipho Dube was found guilty of 30 of the 41 charges against him and sentenced to 10 life sentences plus an additional accumulative 114 years in prison. He screamed profanities at the victims' families as he was led down the stairs of the court. The families of Dube's victims were happy with the sentence, although they acknowledged that nothing would bring back their children. Anele Mbuku's mother had suffered another loss since his death, when her daughter had also passed away. Anele and Siyabonga's remains were never recovered. The Bernardi's family understandably suffered greatly throughout this time, and long after. In fact, the impact of Tina's murder would never truly be repaired. After my initial release of this episode, I was contacted by a member of the Bernardi's family, who informed me that some of the information about their family, from what I had thought at the time was a trusted source, was in fact incorrect. I have removed this information in this iteration of the episode. We ended up chatting for quite some time by messenger, and although those communications will forever remain private, I can tell you that this family, and every single member in it, remains deeply scarred by Dube's crimes. I'm always amazed at the long reach and often unintended effects that this podcast has. Many years after I initially released this episode, I'd been assisting another family through their court battle for justice for two of their murdered family members. And one of those family members reached out to me privately to mention that they'd stumbled upon this episode and realized that they had known Tina as a little girl. They'd been in school with her and remembered how terrible it was when she was murdered. They'd always wondered what had happened with the case, but being so young when it happened, also didn't really have many details to start a search for information. They said that as they listened to the episode, they started to realize that this was the case that had, for so long, lurked like a phantom in their memory. They put a surname to Tina and could eventually understand the reality of what had happened. They said that even though it was terrible to hear, they had needed the closure. As someone who had a similar experience with a schoolmate as a child, which in many ways contributed to my true crime obsession and ultimately this podcast, I completely understand that. Thabo Ndlongolo's parents were just glad to have their child's remains back so they could lay him to rest in a proper burial, in a place of their choosing. His mother spoke of her heart breaking as she looked at the photographs of her son's body and saw the damage that had been done to him. In 2010, a suddenly meek and mild Sipho Dube contacted a journalist for the Sowetan and asked him to write a story, requesting that the families of the victims come and visit him in jail so that he could tell them about their children's last moments and apologize to them. It is unknown whether any of them went, but I certainly hope they didn't. Sipho told the journalist that jail was really a hard life,
and he realised now how much pain he had caused. He complained that his fellow inmates were afraid of him, and he didn't know why. Sipho Dube is a case that, in my opinion, explains how serial murders, and murders in general, can remain unsolved for decades. Sipho lived the life of a phantom. He had no roots and nothing to bind him anywhere, and that worked in his favour when he hunted his victims. He was a stranger to his victims. And even when he so blatantly inserted himself into an investigation, he presented himself as so completely disenfranchised that no one thought he could be capable of the savagery that lay before them. If it hadn't been for Alfred Nyanga, Tina's dad, and then the man who refused to let an attempted car thief get away, Sipho Dube might still be out there. In this case, it's difficult to say whether profiles or police investigations would really have helped. In the end, it just took the right combination of circumstances to stop the killer. With a huge number of missing children and unsolved child murders in South Africa, the question must be asked: how many more Sipho Dubes are out there at this very moment? There is a very good chance that Sipho Dube will die in prison, if he has not already and it's remained unreported to the public. The memory of his victims will live on in the minds of their parents and those who loved them. They were innocent children, and they should never have been memories. But thanks to a man whose anger was stronger than his humanity, remembering them is now all we can do. Rishanti Singh, Lukanyo Kuane, Thabo Dlongolo, Nomnikelo Jumba, Anele Mbuku, Siyabonga Mbuku, and Tina Bernardes. Rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. TCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform, and if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za and support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.